UFOs? Are they aliens? Government secret projects? The imaginings of disturbed individuals? Or just outright hoaxes? We're here to find out. Welcome to Jim Harold's UFO Encounters.
Welcome to UFO Encounters. I am Jim Harold and so glad to be with you today. When looking at this next subject that we're going to talk about, it was a little difficult to categorize it. We could have put it on the Conspiracy Corner feed, or we could have put it on UFO Encounters. So I flipped a coin and we ended up putting it on UFO Encounters. But regardless, it is a fascinating theory that our guest has formed here, and I can't wait to talk to him about it. I'm talking about Dr. Michael Sala, and he is the author of the book Kennedy's Last Stand, Eisenhower, UFOs, MJ-12, and JFK's Assassination. Dr. Sala is a pioneer in the development of exopolitics, which is the study of extraterrestrial life and its political implications. He is the author of 4 books on exopolitics, which include the latest that we just mentioned. Dr. Sala was an assistant professor, researcher, in residence in the School of International Service, American University, from 1996 to 2004, and has a PhD in government from the University of Queensland, Australia. Dr. Michael Sala, welcome to the program today.
Thanks for having me, Jim. Looking forward to it.
So you have a pretty erudite background, and having a PhD in government, you would think that perhaps this is not necessarily an area that you would get into. What made you turn your attention into this and get into such a unique area of study?
Well, it really was just information that I received at a time when I was openly looking for some solutions to some of the problems that I was facing in my academic career. I had been working for well over a decade in international conflicts. And so at that point, I was really kind of frustrated with the way in which international conflicts just seemed to perpetuate themselves despite the efforts of people like myself that were trying to come up with solutions to these conflicts. So I was open for new information that would help explain why these conflicts were so intractable, and I had done research and done field work in conflicts like Kosovo and Sri Lanka and East Timor. So I was very familiar with the dynamics, and so I was really looking for some other explanation. And then in 2001, I heard the Disclosure Project press conference, the video of it, and I saw that, and it really just opened me up to just a new layer of extraterrestrial, or I should really be more correct and say international politics, which is the extraterrestrial factor. That this was a layer I had never before contemplated in terms of a force driving international politics. But when I saw that Disclosure Project press conference, I realized that this was something that was really worth exploring and analyzing. And as I began to explore it more and more, I became convinced that this really was very important for understanding the way in which international conflict perpetuates itself. And I have been doing that research ever since. Unfortunately, my university colleagues didn't agree with that. But nevertheless, it is something that I think really helps explain what is happening internationally.
And it seems you're not the only one who had an interest. In your book, you point out that former President Bill Clinton had an interest and made it very clear upon becoming president. Can you talk about that? Because I find that fascinating.
Well, that's right. It really was a very important historical effort by President Clinton to get to the bottom of 2 things that he felt were so important that he would get one of his close friends to go over to the Department of Justice and actually try to explore what it was that was really happening behind the scenes in terms of these 2 questions. And one was, who killed John F. Kennedy? And the second was, what's the truth behind UFOs? And so he tasked Webster Hubble, a close friend, to go over to the Department of Justice. And Hubble was a senior attorney at the Department of Justice while he was trying to find answers to these questions. And unfortunately for Clinton, Hubble didn't make any great progress, even though he had the resources of the Department of Justice behind him. And we know all this from the memoirs of Webster Hubble, who wrote the book Friends in High Places, where he talked about this task that he was given by President Clinton. And we know from what transpired later in terms of Hillary Rodham Clinton and Bill Clinton going to see Lawrence Rockefeller, that in fact there was a demonstrable interest in the UFO issue by both Clintons, and there were documents in existence to prove it.
I think that's fascinating. I think in your book you say something about, to the essence, that President Clinton told Hubble, if I send you to justice, I want you to find out two things. One, who killed JFK? And number two, are UFOs real? That was pretty fascinating coming out of the mouth of a president.
Well, that's right. And it's very revealing, too, because it shows you one of the dynamics involved in this whole issue, which is that the information concerning UFOs is very highly classified, and even a president, a sitting president, doesn't have need to know. And so it requires understanding the way the classification system works, so that even though, you know, a president can have various security clearances, even he can be blocked from accessing a classified project which has security protocols requiring clearances that the president himself doesn't have, and he just can't give it to himself. It has to be given to him by the project managers of these programs, and these people are entirely autonomous. And and really, there's a number of instances where you've seen this going on. In 1997, a vice admiral at the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Tom Wilson, tried to get access to one of these UFO classified programs, and even he was denied. So it shows you a president and even the sitting head of the intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, even people of that seniority can be denied access.
It's fascinating because I've always heard of a need to know basis, and the thought that the president of the United States would not need to know these things seems pretty incredible, but it seems to be the case.
Well, that's right, yes. I mean, the way these projects are set up, they have a security manager who basically determines who has access and what the requirements are. And absolutely no one gets into that project or gets information about it unless they've been granted access by the security manager. And so that gives these people enormous power, because with the kind of information that they have, whoever has access has power, and those that don't have access, well, you know, they're outside the loop.
Now, going to the other end of this story, the 1940s, late 1940s, after the Second World War, James Forrestal, the first Secretary of Defense, once that position was created from formerly Secretary of War, talk to us about him, who he was, and what he discovered and what he was going to expose and what happened to him.
Well, James Forrestal was initially, he was the Undersecretary of the Navy, and then in 1944 he became Secretary of the Navy, and in 1947 he became Secretary of Defense, the first Secretary of Defense. What was interesting about Forrestal was that as Secretary of the Navy, he obviously had access to the various secrets that the Navy had concerning weapons, armaments, and so forth, because his job was to basically organize the Navy in a way that would make it efficient during the war effort, and also to help the Navy determine what its priorities were in the post-war era. And in 1945, he traveled to Germany in the aftermath of the defeat of the Nazis, and basically surveyed at first hand all of the captured Nazi technologies and all of the scientists. And of course, later on, we learned about Operation Paperclip, where a lot of these secret technologies and the scientists were transferred to the US. But Forrestal was there in Germany in the summer of 1945, just a couple of months after the war ended, basically looking at all of these technologies. And he had as his personal guest in Germany at that time, John F. Kennedy. because he wanted to recruit Kennedy to his personal staff. And so he was on friendly terms with Kennedy. He was close friends with Kennedy's father, Joseph Kennedy. And so Forrestal's importance was that he saw the advanced technologies that the Nazis had. Some of these technologies, documents reveal, were flying saucers with advanced aeronautical capabilities. And John F. Kennedy saw this at first hand. And so he was kind of mentored by Forrestal in terms of these advanced technologies. And we know this because Kennedy wrote a book called Prelude to Leadership about his 1945 summer travel to post-war Germany as the guest of James Forrestal. So you see in Kennedy's own words that he traveled to various locations in Germany with Forrestal and saw the most advanced technologies that the Germans had. Of course, he didn't talk about flying saucers, but he talks about other technologies that he had seen there. And then in 1947, when Forrestal became Secretary of Defense, Kennedy also became a congressman. And so Forrestal continued to see Kennedy and continued to brief Kennedy about all of the things that were happening behind the scenes in terms of flying saucer developments and classified programs involving extraterrestrial life. So this is why Forrestal was such an important figure, especially when it comes to Kennedy's own knowledge about UFOs and extraterrestrial life.
So another figure that's very important in all of this, if you talk about it chronologically, and you mention it in the book, the title of the book, is Eisenhower. And famously, he's well known for, right before he left office, making an impassioned speech about the dangers of the military-industrial complex. Can you talk a little bit about the role of Eisenhower in all this? And also, was that speech in part maybe a cloaked reference in part to this situation?
Yes, definitely. Eisenhower really was targeting a very powerful force that he kind of gave the rubric of the military-industrial complex in his farewell speech. But he was really referring to a committee and the associated elites supporting this committee and associated with it concerning the running of extraterrestrial-related projects. Because as I mentioned earlier, Forrestal with Operation Paperclip, it was realized pretty early on that the kind of technologies that the Nazis were working on were far more advanced than anything the West had. So that these advanced technology projects concerning flying saucers, extraterrestrial life, were relocated to the US, and a committee was set up by President Truman called MJ-12 to oversee these projects. By the time Eisenhower came to power in 1952, what happened was that MJ-12 began to basically go rogue. It began to accumulate power. Eisenhower facilitated that at the beginning of his presidency. And so by the middle to the late 1950s, Eisenhower became disenchanted with Majestic 12 because one of the things that Eisenhower really didn't appreciate was that Majestic 12 went outside the chain of command. You know, as president, Eisenhower, like Truman, saw himself at the apex, at the top of the food chain in terms of who was making decisions. But MJ-12 was basically going rogue. It was making its own decisions without consulting the president, without really giving any information. And so Eisenhower, in 1958, actually was prepared to give orders for the U.S. First Army to invade Area 51, which had become the base of operations for Majestic 12, where it had a secret facility called S4 that was basically where all of these extraterrestrial-related projects and flying saucers and recovered Nazi technologies were all located. So Eisenhower was able to get a little bit of information then, but later on he confided to some trusted military advisors that, in fact, he was very unhappy with the way in which MJ-12 was running the whole extraterrestrial-related program. And so when Kennedy was elected, Eisenhower met Kennedy twice, and the second time shortly before Kennedy was inaugurated, and this was just after after the military-industrial complex farewell speech. And so that's when Eisenhower confided in Kennedy exactly what his main concerns were concerning MJ-12.
Now, Kennedy, for his part, did he go in great guns at the beginning? Did he take a little while to kind of find his footing to maybe try to challenge us? I think the quote from Kennedy that is widely attributed to him by mainstream historians is something to the fact that he wished he could take the CIA and blast it into as a thousand, shatter it to a thousand people pieces to the fourth wind, to the four winds, something like that. That he just wanted to do away with the CIA, and that's well known. I don't think anybody disputes that. Did he come in with this opinion right off, or did like Eisenhower, did it evolve over time?
Well, I think, Jim, that basically Kennedy came in and very quickly took action to try and get to the bottom of what was going on. One of the first things he did was he abolished the Operations Coordination Board, which was really an interagency committee that was doing a lot of the kind of the work involving extraterrestrial life and UFO-related projects, that it was basically, that was its hidden function. And so one of the things he did was to try to get information about what it was doing, its projects, and it failed to volunteer the information. And so he decided then that he would abolish it. And so that was one of his very early executive orders in February of 1961, where he abolished the Operations Coordination Board. And if you look into the history of that particular committee, you'll see how important it is for the whole extraterrestrial UFO phenomenon. So that was one of the things he did. When he didn't succeed in getting the information he required from that, the next approach he did was that he contacted the CIA director, Alan Dulles, to find out what it was Majestic 12 was doing. And Dulles basically, by that time, this was June of 1961, Dulles at that time had been notified that he was not going to be reappointed as CIA director. So he didn't cooperate at all with Kennedy. And later on, he basically replied to Kennedy saying that Majestic 12, even though it was working on the UFO issue, that it was not going to volunteer any of this information to Kennedy because it was of a very sensitive nature. And behind the scenes, Dulles was taking action to basically block Kennedy from learning anything about the UFO issue.
And what's ironic is that didn't he take a key role in the Warren Commission after Kennedy was assassinated?
Well, that's exactly right, that that the Warren Commission really was a farce. And one of Dulles's jobs was to ensure that it would be a farce, that it wouldn't do anything beyond just basically corroborate the theory that Lee Harvey Oswald was a lone nut conspiracy crackpot, and basically he was the one that shot Kennedy. And so this is really what the Warren Commission did, and it was done under Dulles's tutelage. He was there to basically make sure that nothing embarrassing emerged in terms of this CIA's role in the assassination of Kennedy and various other agencies' complicity in covering this up.
So how close and what steps did Kennedy take to blow the lid off the UFO story? What did he do to disclose, and how close did he come to disclosing everything?
Well, there are a number of things he did during his administration, and I mentioned the official efforts he made in terms of trying to get the Operations Coordinating Board and the CIA director to cooperate in terms of the UFO issue. That failed. So then he did an end run where he was using his powers as commander-in-chief to visit various military facilities to see what was in hand there. And so he did travel to various facilities, Homestead Air Force Base in Florida. He traveled to that, and he was able to see some of the flying saucer remains. and also Robert Kennedy behind the scenes was meeting with high-level whistleblowers to basically find out what was going on in this issue. And one of the people he was consulting with was Colonel Philip Corso, who was at the time the head of the Foreign Technology Desk for the Pentagon, for the Army in particular. And so he was briefing Robert Kennedy, who in turn was briefing John F. Kennedy about the UFO issue. And so by the end of his administration, or I should say just shortly before his assassination, in November of 1963, Kennedy basically began cooperating with the Soviet Union on joint missions to the moon and space, and part of that was to share information concerning UFOs. And so this was one of the – basically this was the last initiative that he did to try to get to the bottom of this issue, because he believed that this created a plausible rationale for why the CIA would be constrained to release classified UFO files to NASA and the Department of State and other related departments and agencies in order to cooperate fully with the Soviet Union in joint missions into space.
So they killed him. Who are they? Who do you believe was behind this? And after you give me that, I want to know, beyond who was involved in it, who was aware of it?
Well, the most important document here is something called the Burned Memo. And that is a memorandum that was basically rescued from being burned after the death of James Jesus Angleton, who was the head of CIA's counterintelligence division right up until, I believe it was early 1970s. So this Burn memo, it was a draft document, and basically it outlined the steps that Majestic 12 was going to take in basically curtailing President Kennedy's efforts to get to the bottom of the UFO phenomenon. And one of the directives was called Project Environment. And it's a cryptic assassination directive. It enabled Majestic 12, it basically authorized Majestic 12 to assassinate any political leader who was an obstacle to MJ-12's goals. And so this was something that actually released or was leaked, this document. And the important thing is that it's actually mentioned in another document, which was the top secret memorandum that President Kennedy sent to the director of the CIA in November of 1963, who at the time was John McCone, instructing the CIA to release classified UFO files to NASA, and that NASA would then ensure that the files were distributed to others, the Soviet Union and so forth. And in the there was handwriting on that memorandum, and the handwriting was by William Colby, who was a senior CIA official, saying that that Angleton has the MJ-12 directive. So there you have basically smoking gun evidence that in response to this memorandum that Kennedy had sent to John McCone, he basically forwarded this memorandum to William Colby for advice in terms of, well, what do we do about this? Kennedy wants us to release classified UFO files. Well, you know, who has authority over those and what to do? Colby responded that Angleton has the directive, which was basically saying that Angleton knew how to respond to this request by Kennedy. And Angleton's response was, in fact, an assassination. This was the assassination directive that Angleton had, and he basically implemented it. This was the kind of red line that MJ-12 had drawn 2 years earlier, if Kennedy got too close in terms of trying to get access to these files. So there we have a smoking gun document with handwriting basically pointing the finger at the CIA's counterintelligence division run by Angleton, and also to the MJ-12 committee that in 1961 basically drafted an assassination directive, and Alan Dulles was a part of that MJ-12 committee at the time.
Now, Angleton himself is a very mysterious figure, isn't he?
Well, Angleton was basically a very powerful spy. In fact, the most powerful spy in the CIA, because he was head of the counterintelligence division. And in terms of basically his job was to spy on the spies. That was his job, to find out who in terms of the CIA may have been infiltrated by the Soviet bloc and may not be trustworthy. So Angleton had enormous power. And this was logically the most obvious department by which the Majestic 12 Committee could work with in terms of maintaining security concerning UFOs and extraterrestrial life, that it would be the CIA's counterintelligence division, headed by Angleton, that would basically have responsibility to ensure that there was absolute secrecy when it came to this issue, which is why President Kennedy had such a hard time trying to get access to these files, because basically they were the crown jewels of the CIA's secret intelligence, and it wasn't something that rank-and-file CIA officials knew. It was something that was closely guarded by Angleton and the counterintelligence division.
So how did Angleton put the plan in place? I'm assuming that Lee Harvey Oswald was just one relatively small component of a much, much larger operation.
Well, that's correct, yes. There was a plan to assassinate Castro, and so the CIA had put together a various assortment of killers and mafia hitmen and so forth that would basically perform this job of assassinating Castro. But what happened was that morphed over time, and that the target now shifted from Castro to Kennedy when Kennedy got too close to the CIA's crown jewels. And Angleton, being the person who basically was familiar with all of the key players in this effort to put together an assassination team to kill Castro, then later on that had morphed into a plan to kill Kennedy. And one of the key people involved in this plan to operationalize it all was Lyndon B. Johnson, who was a former senator from Texas, and of course was vice president at the time. And Johnson was the person who basically was responsible for Kennedy's itinerary when he was visiting Texas. And so Johnson was the man that knew where Kennedy would be. He knew the logistics of the people that would be protecting Kennedy. And so Johnson was party to this plan that Angleton quickly put together to basically remove Kennedy once it became clear that Kennedy was a threat to MJ-12 operations. So Angleton, along with Lyndon Johnson, along with Alan Dulles, who had authorized this assassination directive back in 1961, these were the key people that basically put together the assassination plot to kill Kennedy.
So, do you think that the living former presidents that were still alive, particularly I'm not sure if Hoover was alive. I believe Hoover was alive, but Truman and Eisenhower. Do you think that once this happened, they probably said, "Yep, I know what happened," or do you think that they were pretty much ignorant of this whole? Well, they couldn't be ignorant of the whole situation, particularly Eisenhower, because you mentioned he's very concerned about it. But do you think that he personally chalked it up himself as a work of the CIA?
I'm sure Eisenhower was familiar with what Kennedy was doing, because they actually did meet After Kennedy began to do the various things he was doing to try to get to the bottom of the UFO issue. So Eisenhower knew what Kennedy was doing, and probably he was able to kind of figure out that this was something that that the CIA had a hand in, or the Majestic 12 had a hand in. But of course, being out of power, being a former president, I mean, this is not something he could know for certain. But certainly when you look at the what happened, the details of the assassination itself, in terms of the way in which the Secret Service was basically not doing the things that it would normally do to protect the president, those sorts of events would have really made it quite clear to any observer who was knowledgeable about the security details or the processes for a sitting president that, in fact, that there had been a high-level intervention here to make sure that the Secret Service couldn't do its job of protecting the president, which in turn made it possible for him to be assassinated.
Now, assuming that you're correct in this theory, and it is a wide-ranging theory and all-encompassing in many ways, can obviously it's still covered up. It's kind of out there, but in plain sight, and it doesn't go with kind of the mainstream narrative of history that that you hear. What some people might say, well, and I think that this would be kind of silly, but they may say, well, that was 50 years ago. What impact does that have on my life today? Assuming you are correct in your theory, what impact does all of this have on our lives today, other than just interesting reading?
Well, the most important thing to realize here is that, I mean, that book, Kennedy's Last Stand, is based on a lot of documents that have been either leaked or declassified. As far as the leaked documents are concerned, what that means is that there are high-level whistleblowers who are leaking information concerning what really happened with Kennedy, what really happened in terms of the cover-up of the UFO flying saucer issue. So it shows you that there are people in high positions of authority that want the information to come out, because I think that they realize that what has been created here, it truly is a Frankenstein, that Majestic 12 and its control over the UFO flying saucer issue is a Frankenstein that has kind of morphed into something that is really a threat to the welfare of the American public, not only because these technologies are being denied at a time when we have pollution, we have so many international conflicts being waged over oil resources, we have so many things that would be alleviated if these advanced technologies were released. Also, we have the black budget, we have crime, we have the drug trade, we have manipulation of Wall Street, money laundering, all of these things that are designed to raise enormous amounts of money to be basically used for these covert operations. So these are some of the things that would be changed if people began to really engage with the truth behind the Kennedy assassination, because this is probably as close as we're going to get to finding out what has truly happened historically for the Kennedy assassination, and what affects us today in our lives in terms of the way these extraterrestrial UFO projects are being secretly run.
Well, it is a fascinating discussion, a fascinating book, and really kind of a new way of thinking about a couple of different topics that have fascinated many for many decades. Dr. Sala, where can folks find the book and also more information about all of your work in the area of exopolitics?
Sure. Well, the best place to go in terms of my own work is concerned is to just go to exopolitics.org. That's spelled EXOPOLITICS. .org, and there you'll find all of my articles, books, and so forth. And Amazon.com has the Kennedy's Last Stand as well. So those are the two places to visit.
Well, thank you very much for your time today. It was certainly a pleasure, and continued success.
Thank you, Jim. I'm so happy that you had me on your show, and thanks for being a vehicle for getting the truth out to people. Appreciate it.
And thank you for tuning in today. We certainly appreciate your time. Thank you for listening to UFO Encounters, and keep your eye to the sky. We'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye, everybody.